Hello, hello, hello. Okay, well, here we are. It's my little red light is on. Please watch that little red light. If it seems to start fading, it means we need to put in new batteries. Okay. It shouldn't happen, but it might. We're June 19th. We're at the Nikko Hotel in San Francisco. And Dennis, pronounce your name for us.
Dennis Rothar.
Dennis Rothar, who served in Vietnam from 66 to 68?
Yes, I was with IVS until 68, and then I stayed on until 69 with committee of responsibility.
Oh, great. Okay, well, we can talk about that. That's just as interesting, probably less understood, mm-hmm. So we can do that too. What was your birth date?
June 4. That's great. June 8, 1944. I usually get it right.
June 8, 1944, and where were you born?
Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Fort Wayne, Indiana. Did you go to high school in Indiana?
No, I came to California when I was 3, mm-hmm. and grew up mostly in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Went to high school in Glendale.
At Glendale High School?
No, Hoover High School.
Hoover High. Okay. And we never played them. They were in a different league.
No,
I was in West Hill. One of the things we always ask everyone is something about their family background. Are you from a large family or small?
One brother, one sister.
One brother, one sister. And what did your parents do?
My father was a machinist, mm-hmm. Working in the aerospace industry. And my mother had been a school teacher, but then got fired when she got married. And then basically never worked outside the home while I was growing up.
Mm-hmm. And did... if you had to think back as to kind of root experiences when you're growing up even that might have led to you joining the IVS or doing that kind of work, can you think of any of those?
Well, I think the primary thing is that my family has always been very active in the Methodist Church, and I think that sort of led into it. I'm not involved in it anymore, mm-hmm. but my family generally is, and that's the background I grew up in, and it was a sort of a culture where you did things on the order of IVS. That's a little more mm-hmm. spectacular, perhaps, than what most people do, but, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it involves more dedicated time and all, but mm-hmm. but generally it was an atmosphere of doing, for want of a better term, charitable work.
Mm-hmm. Why IVS? How did you hear about it? Let me backtrack and ask another question. Were you aware of your draftability?
Yeah, but I wasn't terribly conscious of it. Mm-hmm. I was a senior in college, and
where was that?
At Stanford, uh-huh. and looking for something on the order of the Peace Corps to do. The Peace Corps had fairly recently been started. I heard about IVS from a guy who was then the director of youth services or something, I'm not sure the exact title, for the Methodist Church in Northern California. Mm-hmm. He had been traveling in Asia and had, I don't know if you knew about IVS before, but he had visited various mm-hmm. IVS people. In Vietnam, and I think maybe even in Laos too, and he told me about it, and the Vietnam War was getting really hot, and it was sort of the place to be, and it sounded like a great idea. I could do a Peace Corps-like thing in a place that I was really interested in, where everything was happening, and I decided to do it, and then somebody suggested, and I don't remember who this was, suggested to me that I might use it as alternative service for the draft, so I don't know if I had thought before then about being a CO or not, but then I, maybe I had and had already signed up, I'm not sure, but then I applied to use this as alternative service, and I had a real easy draft board. I think it was famously easy in West Hollywood, and they gave it to me. And that was all there was to it. I didn't think much about it, I just did it.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So you, after you applied to IVS, you were accepted, and you went to Harper's Ferry for
Yep, went to Harper's Ferry in August of 1966.
Mm-hmm. And what did you, how did you, what was your reaction to that? I'll ask a more specific question, but generally, how did you feel about the Harper's Ferry experience?
Besides, I was having
beautiful.
A great time.
Yeah.
It was overwhelming in a way. I probably had a fairly good general knowledge of Vietnamese politics or the politics of Vietnam and the United States at the time. I didn't have any real appreciation of the history of the country or certainly of the culture. And it was the first time I got to meet real for sure Vietnamese. And
What Vietnamese did you encounter there?
I don't remember who they were. There were two or three mm-hmm. who were people who'd had connections with IVS who came in and, you know, there they were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was beginning to seem real, like we were really going to go. And it began to put some flesh on all of this. You know, this was really something that was going to happen. And so it was pretty exciting stuff.
Mm-hmm. A couple of specific questions. Were you at that time, did you know you're going into community development? I mean, that was a seminal.
Right. Okay. That's where they were sending practically everybody. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any particular interest in teaching, and mm-hmm. that was the alternative.
What was your major in college?
Well, I majored in math until the first quarter of my senior year when I switched to sociology in the middle of registration, and then I raced through a soc major in my senior year. Mm-hmm. And that, so my degree is in sociology, but I don't know anything.
Well, Ronald Reagan was a socialist.
That's right.
Hey, talk about, hey, let's point these fingers where
that's
they belong.
Right, that's right.
But the,
he's my hero.
Yes. Were you aware, since you were more interested, and this is very common, by the way, more common than it would seem, that you were interested in service.
Mm-hmm.
You were fascinated by Vietnam as mm-hmm. as an issue, you know, of your day and et cetera. And when did you realize or know all along that this was a contract service for USAID?
Oh, I don't know when I found that out. Whenever it was, it didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
It was never an issue. I can't imagine I knew that from the beginning. Mm-hmm. I may have learned it in Harper's Ferry.
Mm-hmm.
Most likely, I suppose, I learned it in some sort of literature that I got before I signed up or as I signed up.
And it would make no difference because?
I don't know. I guess because I didn't want to care about that. I think if you had forced me to examine the issue, I would have found a way to draw a distinction between working in contract with the U.S. government as opposed to being in the U.S. Army. You know, I think I could have figured out an explanation that would still allow me to go. I mean, and that was really what was going on. You know, I was going to go come hell or high water. I could justify it.
Which isn't that unusual, actually,
mm-hmm.
for most volunteers. Did you do any additional, any specific training in language, for example, or anything like that at Harper's Ferry?
No language at all. I believe that the only thing we did at Harper's Ferry, I don't think we did anything technical there, and I don't think we did any language. I think we did history stuff and mm-hmm. cultural.
Do you remember any of the any guest lectures or events that just stand out from that experience? Speech by a director of IVS, for example. Because there were some interesting speeches, by the way, that some remember with great clarity.
Is that
others,
right?
I don't know, I was in a room for a while with some interesting people. But
No, I don't remember anything like that. I remember kind of the gestalt of the experience,
mm-hmm,
I think.
Mm-hmm. Was there a sense that, did anyone try to sell you on the idea that what you were doing with IVS was going to help, not so much the U.S. war effort, but U.S. anti-communist interests? Was that ever?
Well, I remember discussions about that. I don't remember anybody official with IVS promoting that, but
mm-hmm.
but it became clear among our group that we had a range of political views,
mm-hmm.
and there were some people who, there were people all the way from really fervent anti-war people, and I'm probably among that group, to the people at the other end who were doing their patriotic duty. And what I remember generally about those discussions is a tremendous amount of mutual respect. People really were treating each other pretty nicely about it. And we weren't getting into fights.
No. Did you? But do you remember anybody who was in that cohort, in that group that went out with you?
Do I remember any of the specific
people? Do you
remember
any of those people? Yeah.
Oh, sure. I'm not sure how many I could name, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. Give it a try. Just, no, this is just for background, just so we can see who served with whom in what group.
Okay, let's see. Ron Farrelly, Dick Berliner, Wayne, is his name Brazil? He's the one who I mentioned to you before
right.
The tape was on, where he got drafted and I believe he got sent back to Vietnam.
Okay.
Actually, I'm not sure about his last name. I think it may be a different Wayne than I'm thinking. But anyhow, let's see. Partly I get confused because there were a whole bunch of groups that went at the same time and we met up in various other places.
Well, that's okay. Other names are going to come up.
Yeah, right.
Oh, no, it's a casual thing. I remember Stu Rawlings was saying that we went to this place and Dennis was raising mushrooms.
Yeah, that's in Vietnam.
In Vietnam, right. And the thing is, this helps us kind of like put, he didn't say which Dennis it was.
Mm-hmm.
I knew which Dennis it was, and then I could say, you mean,
yeah,
you know, see,
right.
like that, and we can clarify that so the pieces come together a little bit better on the tape. Did you go to the Philippines for rice training?
Yes, we did.
And what was that like?
That was a lot of fun. That was, I had spent, 6 or 8 weeks in Mexico the summer right after I graduated from high school. And that was the only other real experience I had in a foreign country. So this was the first time I really felt like I was living in a foreign country. And it was a good time. It felt like we were really getting underway, that this was really serious stuff. And we got to do fun things. I still remember plowing with a water buffalo who didn't want to turn when I wanted to turn. And I, someplace at home, I've got an 8x10 picture of all of us planting rice. And we learned all sorts of stuff that seemed really cool at the time that we thought was going to be terribly useful, like bamboo engineering, where you could cut up bamboo and you could make pipes and you could do all sorts of things. And they sent me a place with no water buffaloes, no rice, and not enough bamboo that anybody could share with me. So I never used any of that stuff again. But it was a lot of fun to learn. And I often think back to plowing with the water buffalo and thinking, you know, that was the only chance I ever got to do that. I never actually got to do it in Vietnam, but it made me feel a little bit like I knew something of what rice farmers have to go through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's generally what people feel about it. I think is, you know, this is a plow, this is a rice seedling. You know, there's a certain basic charm to it.
Yeah.
But also there has to be kind of a halfway. You have to do something before you find yourself in country.
Yeah.
And at least this has a bit of familiarization.
Right, right. Plus it was real good for our group to have that kind of experience together, you know, to... It made the group cohesive.
Well, that's another question. Did you feel that you could have been that since you're all going to, some of you are going to work in teams, some of you are going to work in relative isolation, but when you got together would need to communicate, was there, do you think, an adequate attention paid to developing a sense of teamwork amongst IVSers or an identity amongst IVSers?
Well, when I got to Vietnam, I was in isolation. I was all by myself. They forgot about me in the Tet Offensive. You know, they just... I was really out there, and I sort of enjoyed that. You know, I enjoyed sort of the cachet of being isolated like that. But at the same time, I was envious of those people who were in little groups, you know, got to see each other a lot and got to work together. So by then, it didn't matter to me too much how cohesive the group was, mm-hmm. except that, when I could make it to Christmas parties and things like that, then I would see these people who I knew from before.
Mm-hmm.
Other people in the organization had more constant contact with people.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience was more always relating back to the people who I had seen in some event sometime before.
Right.
And there were people, who, for example, who I saw at Harper's Ferry who I probably never saw again. I think we had an English group with us there, English teachers as well as the CD group.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about that. If we did, the CD group alone went to the Philippines, and those English teachers, maybe I saw them at a Christmas party, memory, and never saw them again.
Right.
So looking back at it, I'm grateful for any chance that we had to get to know each other.
Mm-hmm. When you flew into Saigon.
Yeah.
And then what was your first experience of arriving in Vietnam?
They confiscated all our knives.
That's
right. We'd all bought bolos in the Philippines,
uh-huh.
Like machetes there.
Uh-huh.
They're like, they have a blade of 18 inches long or something. Uh-huh. And most everybody in the group had bought one. And I don't know who first revealed that we had them. And they confiscated them all. They eventually gave them back to us, but that's the first thing I remember is just trying to get through customs.
Mm-hmm.
It was very hot and sweaty. I remember that, and which is sort of interesting that I remember that, because the Philippines must have been so too,
mm-hmm.
and I don't remember it so much from there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was dirty and crowded and loud and kind of confused,
mm-hmm.
but we were still having a good time.
And did you go directly to the IVS house?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And how long did it take before you got your assignment? Or wait, did you go to language school at that
point? Went to language school in Vinh Long.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were six or eight of us or so in our group there. And we, when did we spend? 6 weeks there? I'm not sure. Something on that order, where we all lived in this big house.
Mm-hmm.
Bin Laden, and we had a couple of teachers who came in and taught us, and the maids taught us, and we did language training and watched movies. We'd go to MACD at night and watch movies.
Mm-hmm.
And did that for whatever it was, 6 weeks, and it was during that time that we got our assignments.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember how long into it was.
Mm-hmm. At the end of 6 weeks, did you feel fairly comfortable? How was your language?
I didn't. I see myself as being real bad at language, and I probably have a bit of a block and wasn't a great student. I was getting along reasonably well, but not well enough to really take care of myself on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I could get through a meal, and I could buy things in the market, and I could sort of get along. I was probably, in a way, ready to go, just because it was time to go.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I could have used more training or not, but I think it was probably adequate,
mm-hmm.
but just barely.
Mm-hmm. Several people said that they don't think they could have stood more.
I think they
needed to be, just get out.
I think that is probably about right for me. I'm not sure I'd thought of it before, but the timing wasn't bad.
And so what was your first assignment?
I went to Kaibab, which is a district town that, as the crow flies, is just across the river from Vinh Long, but it's across a couple of branches of the river and an island. And, it's a fairly long distance, and you can't get there by crow. You have to, if you go around on road, you have to go up toward, up to the west, and then go across on a ferry, and then come back on road across. Now that I think of it, I don't really remember much about going there, but we must have gone by road. The other way would be to catch a helicopter, and to get to Kaibab, you just have to find a place where there are helicopters flying and just talk around until you see somebody that's going by that way, because
mm-hmm.
it's not a normal stop.
Just for the tape, describe the location of that village, the province,
or
whatever.
It's I don't know what the province is now called. It's got a new name. Mm-hmm. It was Dintung Province then. The capital is Mitaw. Mitaw is a fairly substantial town, as Vietnamese towns go, and it's on the north side of the northernmost major branch of the Mekong River. And then the province spreads out along the river going toward the west. Mitaw is pretty close to the eastern end of the province. It includes some islands out in the river, too. Highway 4, which is the highway that goes from Saigon down into the delta, comes down from the north into Mitaw, and then it swings almost due west and goes across the province. And then as you go along, there are a number of district towns. And Cai Bao was, I think, the second or third district town out. I'm not really sure how far it was, but it took about half a day to drive from Mitaw to Cai Bao. It's probably a matter of 40 or 50 kilometers. It's just they were always blowing up the roads was the problem.
Yes, that's the problem. So this would be actually about maybe 60 miles. I just want to get the west-east thing. About 60 miles south-west of Saigon?
I'm not sure about the distance, but it's certainly southwest of Saigon. As the road goes slightly southwest to get to Mitaw, and then it goes much more sharply west. And then when it gets to the neighborhood of Cai Bao, it actually gets into the district of Cai Bao, it's going across the top of the district. In administrative terms, a district is pretty much like a county in the United States, and a province is pretty much like a state, except everything's on a much smaller scale. And the highway goes through the top of Cai Bao District, and then there's a little two-lane road that, the highway is two-lane, but it's better pavement. Just a little road that then goes due south down to the bottom of the district, probably a distance of, I don't know, 4 or 5 kilometers. And then the town of Cai Bao is right on the river at the intersection of a fairly substantial canal and the river. Mm-hmm. And the town itself, the population, I don't know, a couple of thousand, a real small town. But it was a pretty important town because it's a place where the road and the river meet, mm-hmm. and barges could come in to the town, and it was a place where farmers could bring things like produce in to sell, and then trucks could come in and haul things out, mm-hmm. and Cai Bao had always been famous for oranges, and there were oranges growing all over the place. By the time I was there, there weren't that many oranges because, you know, the land was being shot up and bombed and so forth. The rice farmers who had most of the territory around there were not farming rice because we turned it all into free fire zones, and then those people became the refugees I worked with. I think there was still a fair amount of fruit farming on the islands and the river, but those weren't places that I ever spent any appreciable amount of time. But Cai Bao was sort of a joke in a way among Vietnamese. If I was in Saigon or something, and Vietnamese would ask me where I was from, I'd say Cai Bao. It's sort of like, I'm not sure if there's a general place in the United States that you can say. In the Bay Area, it's like saying you're from Milpitas. Mm-hmm. It's worse than, much worse than Milpitas. Mm-hmm. It's a place where nobody would ever want to be who's never been there. And people first couldn't believe that I was serious. And then when they decided I was serious, they thought I must have done some horrible thing because it's exile. Cai Bao actually is a beautiful little town. Yeah. It had old colonial French architecture. It had a wonderful church that sat in a very picturesque spot right on the canal. It was a very charming place. Nothing was happening there, though. And if you were a civil servant or somebody like that assigned to a place like that, it was just the ends of the earth. It was really about as far as you could go. And this was a place that was close enough to Saigon that people knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was the most remote nearby place anybody had ever heard of.
Right. It's like people say Ames, Iowa is not the end of the world, but you can see it from here.
Yeah,
but
sort
of
like
more
that.
Remote
but
places
than Ames at least
Iowa.
Has a university.
Exactly,
you know,
right.
Something's
yes.
going on.
Yes.
You know, we had a private secondary school. That was it.
What was the ethnic mix like in that?
Oh, it was virtually all Vietnamese, some Chinese who were merchants, but for the most part, everybody was sort of mixed together. From my point of view, it was real hard for me to know who was Chinese and who was Vietnamese, and it didn't make any day-to-day difference.
There was no Khmer population?
None at all. I don't know how much local people were conscious of ethnic differences. Mm-hmm. I think they probably were much mm-hmm. more conscious than I was, but it was never an issue that I knew mm-hmm. about.
Were there many Catholics in the district?
I don't know how many, but there were enough to keep the church going. There was a priest there. The church, I was never in it for a service. It seemed to be fairly well attended. There was a small Protestant church there that was much... It was very small. There wasn't much going on in it, and I don't know who paid any attention to it. There was a little Buddhist temple in town. Ostensibly, religion wasn't much of a part of everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Well, you arrived there.
I did.
That must have been an interesting experience. How did you start getting settled in?
I was taken there by Willie Montgomery. Willie Myers. Roger Montgomery is a different person. I was taken by Willie Myers, who was my team leader. Mm-hmm. And what I remember almost immediately was him taking me around town buying supplies. That is the first time I remember being out with somebody who spoke really good Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And he could walk into stores, you know, he'd never been there before. And uh-huh. he would walk into these stores, and this was a very strange thing to have two Americans in this town uh-huh. to start with. Uh-huh. And the two of us would walk in, and people would be real surprised to see us, and then he would start spouting Vietnamese, and the grins would get huge. And then we'd walk out with armloads of stuff that he had bought for me, you know, a kerosene stove, and I'm not sure if I got my mosquito net then, but you know, all sorts of stuff that I needed just to set up housekeeping. And so he did that, and he went around and introduced me to people who I'm not sure he knew either. I think he was just finding them and introducing them to me, but they were people like the province chief and the police chief, and there were Americans there. There was a MACV advisory group.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there were two of them. There was a group of, I guess, four or five guys who lived in the district headquarters compound, and they were the advisors to the district government,
right.
and to the local militia. And then there was an Arvin battalion or something, I think it was a battalion, that was stationed in town, and their compound was right next to the district government's compound.
Uh-huh.
And there was a separate group of MACV advisors for that for that Arvin unit, and I rarely saw those people, but they were there. I saw the MACV, the district people, much more frequently.
Uh-huh.
For a long time, I was dependent upon them for my toilet. I didn't have one of my own, and I was across the street, and so I would walk across the street whenever I needed to use the facility.
Uh-huh.
I was also dependent on them for transportation. If I wanted to get out, I'd have to go over and check with them, see when a chopper was coming in, and see if I'd catch a ride. But Willie took me around and introduced me to all these various people, and then he left me. He left me. I don't remember. I think he stayed a couple of days. I think he stayed overnight, but he left me.
What did you live in?
I lived in a room of the building that had been the maternity clinic. Actually, two rooms. The maternity clinic, sometime before I got there, had moved to a newer building on the other side of town. And there was this building. It was an old brick, stucco-covered brick building that had, let me see, there must have been something on the order of six or so pairs of rooms. There would be a room in front and then a room directly behind it. And the front rooms opened onto a covered veranda that went all the way around. I was at one end of that with the two rooms, and actually the veranda turned the corner at my room, and so I had a little bit of a porch going around both sides. At the far end of the same building was the police chief's home and office. And then in between us were some rooms that I think had stuff stored in it, probably government supplies of some sort. Directly behind the building I was in was sort of a large shanty. It was sort of cobbed together of sticks and
properly running.
Okay. But no rhythm. Oh, there's a rhythm. Okay. So this building housed the families of, I think it was probably the RF, those are the regional forces, who are the provincial level militia, as opposed to the popular forces that are the district level militia. And I don't know how many people lived in there, but it was the floors were mud. I mean, it was pretty wet, and it was just a whole bunch of families who were sort of crowded in that place behind me. Then directly across from me was the office of the Revolutionary Development, whatever organization. I don't know what the word was, but those were the Vietnamese people who were supposed to be pacifying the everybody. They were the people who were working with USAID and whatever they were supposed to be doing to keep everybody happy. So I was sort of living in the midst of all this government stuff, but I had this kind of strange room that in a way was sort of home-like. It had nice tile floor. It's a kind of thing that Californians pay a lot of money for now, called Mexican pavers. And I had brick walls. I had a tin roof. I'm sorry. I had a red tile roof. And it was fairly comfortable. It was nice and cool. So as things went for that neighborhood, I was living in relative luxury. Okay. I had an electric line that came into the room that was, you know, somebody had just spliced a wire into some wire someplace else down the street, and that ran into a couple of hanging bulbs that usually would come on for a couple of hours every evening, but the voltage was usually very low, and it varied so much that it wasn't really usable as a real electric light. It was sort of good enough for a night light, but for a real light, I used a kerosene lantern. After I'd been there for quite a while, probably more than a year, somebody got the bright idea to assign a deputy district chief to the district. And this, I think, was some sort of a Saigon training idea. I think the school that trained government officials in Saigon decided that they were going to have an internship program in effect. And so they sent this kid out who was going to be the deputy district chief. And it was just announced to me that he was going to live with me. And so these two little rooms that I had, they were, each one of those rooms was, oh, I don't know, 8 by 8 or something like that. So he and I were going to live in these two rooms. And I didn't have a whole lot to say about it. I'm living there at the behest of the district government. I live where they tell me I can. So the district chief decided that he would make it palatable to me by enclosing the veranda, and that would give me more space. So they took old ammunition boxes, howitzer shell boxes, and they ripped them up, and they took all the lumber from that, and they enclosed the veranda, and then that gave me an L-shaped room that surrounded the other two rooms, and that considerably expanded the space. And the this deputy district chief was such a jerk that nobody liked him, me first and foremost. I couldn't stand him, and he pissed everybody else off with his attitude. You know, he was real high and mighty from Saigon. He didn't like being out there with the peasants. And he eventually disappeared. I don't know what they did with him, but he was gone. And so now I had this fairly luxurious space all to myself. He needed a toilet. He couldn't go across the street to MacVie or wouldn't or something. So he needed a toilet. So they dug a pit toilet in what had been sort of a closet next to my room. So after he was gone, I had my pit toilet and I had my enclosed veranda. I still didn't have electricity, but I was doing all right. Mm-hmm.
And how did you start your work?
I sort of latched on to Lieutenant Son, who was the guy in charge of revolutionary development. He was an army officer, but he was doing the equivalent. What do they call it? The U.S. Army calls it civilian. Something, I don't know, but it's you know, his job was to do community development for the Vietnamese government, and he was the one who was in charge of receiving things like bulgur wheat and cooking oil and all the stuff that the Americans would donate, and he was in charge of the refugee camps and so forth, and he was a nice guy who I liked, and so I sort of, although I didn't much like the association with the government, I didn't have a lot of choice about it. It was the only game in town, and so I sort of latched onto him and got into things through him. He also spent some time trying to teach me Vietnamese in the evening, and he would take me around to things that were happening in town. I remember he took me to a birthday party and he took me to a funeral, and there were a lot of ways in which he was sort of an entree to the community. And he also was a member of a group of, I think about 4 or 5 at its most, bachelor officers in town who ate together. And so I joined that group. And the group came and went. Sometimes we were down to just 2 of us, and we ate at various houses. But the common thing was that all the time I was there, we were paying some housewife to cook for us. Mm-hmm. And then we would all show up at that house for our meals, for lunch and dinner, and eat. And so that kept me in with that sort of bachelor club, and it meant I didn't have to eat in restaurants all the time, and I got to eat in homes. Mm-hmm. It was a little different from eating with just a regular family, but for a while, the home we ate at was at the police chief's home. And police chief, you know, is a very powerful person in a town like that and has lots of money. And we ate real well. You know, they were always trying to show off how good they could provide for us. And so we were living at the top of society.
And just as a point of curiosity, it just seems strange that when you arrived there wasn't a ready-made assignment, you know, that where you didn't Willie say you'll be working with them or...
Well, no, I think Willie had something to do with me getting linked up with Lieutenant Sung. Okay. That it was the natural thing to do. He may have actually introduced us to each other. Mm-hmm. There wasn't much else possible for me. I was going to work with refugees, and if I was going to work with refugees, I had to at least cooperate with this guy.
Okay, well, let's run back there a second. Yeah. You were going to do community development work, but when you went out to this town, you believed that your assignment would be to work with refugees?
Right. No,
from the very beginning.
It was called community development, mm-hmm. but my assignment was to work with the refugees.
Okay, all right.
And I don't think anybody ever seriously thought I was going to develop a community.
Right.
I mean, that was a catch-all name for people who weren't doing agriculture and who weren't doing education.
Right.
And if anybody ever thought there was going to be a community developed among the refugees, they were sorely deluded.
No, I don't think so. I mean, it sounds like that under this is a rubric of community development, but some people might start, you know, a hog program. Others would introduce fruit crops.
Right.
Your job was to work with refugees.
My job was to work with refugees, and I was at a complete loss mm-hmm. what to do, and got no real help. But I'm not complaining about that because I'm not sure there was anybody who could have given me a great deal of help. I think what happened under the circumstances is probably about as good as it could have been. Mm-hmm. From the point of view of the refugees, it wasn't terribly useful. From my point of view, it was good for me. Mm-hmm. I got into a number of things. Partly, I just allowed myself to be used. I could do things that the Vietnamese couldn't do, and I could do things that the U.S. Army wouldn't do. Somebody got the idea, and I don't know whose idea it was, that we could get the refugees to make handicrafts that we would they would sell to the American military. Now, as I was in language training in Vinh Long, Lyndon Johnson was busy saying to the American public, "We'll never put troops in the Delta." While we were in language training, we knew that they were building a base at Dong Tom, right outside of My Tho, for the American troops. And so we can hear the reports there will never be military troops in the Delta, and we could see them building the base. And then they moved all these troops in. It was a huge number. I think it's, I don't know what. I don't even know how the Army measures these things.
All I know is the PX had television sets.
Right.
I know it was.
It was a division, I think. If you've read the, what's the guy's, the book?
In
Pharaoh's Army.
Yes.
That's Dom Tom.
That's why I said I know their television's
and
there.
When I read that book, he and I were probably in the same room at the same time at some point, because mm-hmm. our lives just overlapped so many places, it's incredible. But in any case, Dom Tom then was a reality shortly after I got to Cai Bao. And somebody got the idea that we could make money selling things to these GIs. I could get into the base. So we would take, the district government had this big old truck. I think it was an International Harvester truck, a steak truck with a, no, it wasn't a steak truck. It had a covered back. It was, you know, the size of the very largest U-Haul, maybe slightly larger than that. It was a pretty substantial truck, and they had this, for some reason, to haul cooking oil around or something. I don't know what it was for. But we would get in that truck, Lieutenant Son and the driver, and I don't know, sometimes one or two other people, and I would get in this truck, and we would drive to Dong Tom. And the driver would drive all the way up to a few hundred yards from the gate. And then we'd get out, and I'd get behind the wheel. And then we would drive into the base, and, you know, I was an American. I could talk to the guard at the base, and they didn't care. I'd say, these are my friends, they're from the Vietnamese Army, and we're coming in here. And they'd let us in, and then we would go to the artillery place, and we would pick up all of the howitzer shell boxes that they would let us take, and we would load up the truck with those, and then we'd drive them back to Kaibab. And then the refugees would take those, and they would rip them apart, and they would put them back together as footlockers. And then they would buy, in the Vietnamese market, they would buy sheets of steel from cans. At this point, aluminum cans really hadn't taken hold yet. And throughout Asia, all beer cans were made out of steel, and most beer cans in the world were. And the plants that processed, that made beer cans, would throw away sheets of them that where the printing was slightly off. Mm-hmm. And then those sheets would show up as panels of about 2 foot by 3 foot, I think, in markets all over Asia. And you could buy these sheets of steel that would just have Budweiser, Budweiser, Budweiser or something all over them. And so we would buy these sheets of steel, and they would then wrap the footlockers in those and, you know, put nice little things on them, like little brass studs and all. And then we would haul them all back to Dongtam, and we managed to get a store set up there. And we had a couple of refugees who manned the store, and they would sell back to the GIs the wood that they'd given us in the first place. So we thought this was a great scheme. And then somebody got the even brighter idea, put all the women in the refugee camp to work making black pajamas. And so they just started turning out black pajamas just as fast as they could. And boy, those things sold like hotcakes. And then, and we sold straw hats. You know, these guys couldn't get off the base. And they thought the coolest thing in the world was to have a footlocker that said Budweiser and black pajamas. Yeah, that's right. And so that was kind of a thriving project. But it was a stupid project. Mm-hmm. You know, it made a little bit of cash for people, but it wasn't developing anything. And someplace in there, IVS did a training seminar. Where was it? Up in Lomain, I think, almost up at the Cambodian border, on vegetable growing, I think is what it was. And not having any better ideas, I went to this seminar figuring I should learn how to grow vegetables. And a very small part of it was somebody who was showing how to grow mushrooms. And that really seemed like a great idea to me, and partly because it seemed to fit what we had. We had what we needed to grow mushrooms. Basically, was a little bit of land, some rice straw, and the mushroom spores. And so I found out how to do it, and I came back, and then I started this project of teaching refugees to grow mushrooms. And it actually didn't involve very many people, and economically it was a complete bust, but we were having a great time. And the problem with it ultimately was that it depended entirely on my ability to go to Saigon and pick up the spores from a woman at the Ministry of Agriculture who was busy making these in her autoclave in some back room. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would go in and she'd give me a bottle of spores, and I would run down, and then we would set up a mound and grow a lot of mushrooms, and we'd get through two or three rounds of mushrooms, and then it'd be so polluted with other kinds of spores that we'd have to destroy that and start again. And the whole process depended on me getting the spores. While it would make a great deal of money for the people who were growing the mushrooms, hidden in there was the cost of me and my transportation and all of that. So in the long term, it couldn't succeed. But while it was going on, we were having a good time. The local restaurants had all the mushrooms they could handle, and people were making a pretty fair amount of money on it, but just not very many people. Mm-hmm. And everybody thought it was pretty amusing. People would come around every time we'd start to make a new mound. There, we'd have a good-sized crowd, and the local officials thought it was great that I was out there growing mushrooms, and so everybody was real happy about it. Let's see, what else did I also had a, for a very short time, I had an audio-visual program. I got a projector from USAID somehow. I don't know. It was one of those things where it just happened. It was available to me, and I locked it up in the office at one of the refugee camps. There was just this little office that was used occasionally for administrative purposes and all, and it was locked in there. And I could get films from a film library in Mito. They were largely propaganda films, but there were some things that weren't so terrible and some just plain entertaining. And so I would get those and occasionally show films in one of the refugee camps. Then the VC came along and they blew up the office. And the projector just smashed a smithereen. So that ended that program. But that was sort of the way everything went with me forever. It's just a little bit of something that was inconsequential, and then something else, and then something else, and then something else. And I got involved in distributing seeds for a while, but I didn't know nearly as much about vegetables as the farmers did. So I decided I'm not going to try to teach these people farming. It's, you know, I'm no good at that. It doesn't make any sense in terms of development, but for the short run, I can go get seeds for free and give them away. And I remember I had huge, huge supplies of seeds, far more than we had land for. I had a huge box of soap that I got from someplace that, I would give soap away occasionally. I was trying not to be somebody who was just a conduit for stuff, but at the same time, it was probably my most valuable attribute, and so I was making myself available for it and saying, basically, screw the idea of trying to develop here anything here.
When you were there, was that actually during the period when Don Luce turned against the war, so to speak, and there was a letter that was sent to LBJ, and
one of the
was that just.
During the whole time I was there, IVS had a thing where you could send a letter to Washington once a month, and then they would duplicate it. I believe this was a mimeograph machine. Mm-hmm. They would duplicate it and send it out to your mailing list. And being isolated like I was, I had lots of time to write. Mm-hmm. And so I was fairly prolific in my newsletters, and I sent I would send them out fairly faithfully once a month, and my list started really growing, and it included lots of people I'd never heard of. It turned out that the SDS in Madison, Wisconsin published my newsletters under their name. I mean, they were going all over the place. And one of the letters I wrote was really a pretty angry one about the condition of the refugees, and talking about how the whole program should be shut down, and we shouldn't be doing any of this, and so forth. And Don came to visit me fairly shortly after that newsletter went out, and he told me what he and others were planning to do, and basically enlisted my support, although I decided I wasn't going to leave. I think there was the petition went to the New York Times that was published, and I think some of that has its origin in the letter I wrote, and I was one of the signatories on it and all of that. So I knew that it was happening as remote as I was, but that was partly because Don himself came to visit me, and because he knew I cared about that particular issue.
What was that particular issue?
Well,
develop that a little bit.
Well, I was living in a rice-growing area, and the American government policy, and therefore the Vietnamese government policy, was to deny that land to the VC. And in order to deny it to the VC, they made it a free fire zone, which meant if you were there, you were dead. And not too many people farmed under those conditions. Some people did, but not very many did. And then we would forcibly remove the farmers from their land into these refugee camps. And the refugee camps were consisted of thatched houses on relatively small plots of land, interlaced with canals. And then and most of the plots had fish ponds on them. And so people who had been rice farmers were turned into, at best, fish farmers. Some of them were mushroom farmers because of what I was doing. Some of them found little bits of places to put vegetables in there. But basically, they were just sitting there eating what we, the food that we, the American taxpayer, gave to them, mm-hmm. which was really bad stuff. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't farm. You know, they were losing everything. They were losing all their history and everything that made their lives what their lives were supposed to be, and they were just sitting around staring at each other and getting drunk, and it was just pretty miserable. And we were calling these things like New Life Hamlets and acting as though something was really being accomplished and like these people really had a new life. Mm-hmm. And it was really sad. We were destroying these folks and not, as far as I could see, gaining anything from the free fire zones. And as I recall that particular letter I wrote, the thing I was complaining about is these weren't really refugees. They weren't fleeing something. These were people that we had deliberately dislocated. We had picked them up and put them over here and said, this is where you're going to be, and we're going to destroy your land. And I thought it was nuts. Eventually decided I just wouldn't have anything more to do with it, and I left Kaibea at that point, because I decided even the things that I had been doing mm-hmm. probably weren't a good idea, that there's no point to me aiding the system at all, and it wasn't as though the care that I was giving these people was so critical that they'd really miss me.
You didn't have much contact with Vietnamese other than at the refugee camps and in the town center?
No, those were the people I knew. I mean, occasionally I'd go to Mita or Saigon mm-hmm. and I'd see people there, but no. Oh, soldiers coming through, a lot of them, before I had my veranda boxed in, soldiers were often sling their hammocks out in that veranda to stay out of the rain. And I met a lot of soldiers who tied my door closed inadvertently. And I'd get up in the morning, I couldn't get it open. And I'd start banging on the door. It turns out, you know, these little rings that you could put a padlock through.
Right.
And those were just perfect for hanging a hammock. And so somebody would tie my door shut. They thought it was some sort of a storage closet or something. They had no idea there was a human being in there. It really surprised a lot of them when some American would walk out.
You just slowly, over a period of time, you just became more and more frustrated with the nature of what your assignment was,
yeah.
the conditions you were living in. How did you get out? What's the process by which you...
I don't remember exactly. Mm-hmm. I told somebody in authority in IBS that I wanted out and wanted to go someplace else. Mm-hmm. And I got reassigned to Kuntah, which is mm-hmm. the biggest city in the Delta, a place that I had, I think, maybe been once before, but didn't know much about. I don't remember much of the details of it, except that I remember I was told that I was going to go there. I remember I left Kaibea by myself. Nobody came to get me or anything. I had... my possessions consisted of a footlocker and...
Hopefully one of the refugee manufacturers.
No, actually, one I had brought with me. I had that, and I had a couple of suitcases, I think, and maybe some miscellaneous boxes, and I had a motor scooter. And I had to get these out of Kaibea. And I remember I managed to get all these onto a helicopter. I don't know how we did it. I remember struggling. It was in the middle of the night. I remember trying to get that motor scooter into a helicopter, and the gunners were helping me lift it. And they thought this was about the scariest thing they had ever seen. They didn't know they wanted to have any part of it. Uh-huh. But they flew me to Vinh Long. How I managed to get that chopper, how it was in the middle of the night, how it was going the right direction, I don't know. Because most choppers coming through Kaibea would have gone to Metaw, which would have taken me the wrong direction. But they took me to Vinh Long, and they dropped me at the end of the runway, 11 o'clock, midnight or something, in Vinh Long. And so there I was, all by myself. And I remember dragging the footlocker the length of the runway till I found this little hut. And I put it in there, and then I walked back to the other end of the runway, and I got the motor scooter, and I brought everything up, and there was this just little hut. I'm not even quite sure what it was for, and I had a mat with me, and I remember I just spread that out on the concrete floor, and I just went to sleep. And the next morning, I got up, and I got on my motor scooter, and I rode into Vinh Long, and I went to the IVS house, and I found somebody who came back with a scout, and you know, an international harvester, mm-hmm. and we picked up my stuff, and somehow I got from there to Kintah, and then in Kintah, that was not too long after the Tet Offensive, and Kintah had been hit reasonably hard, and I tried a number of different things that trying to get into working with real refugees there. I mean, these were people who had been displaced by the fighting around Tet, and there were a number of inconsequential false starts, and nothing really worked. And I hadn't been there too long before I decided this just wasn't working. And I had had an offer from Committee of Responsibility some time earlier to go to work for them, and I had turned it down. And I don't know if I sought it out or if they came back to me. Somebody was leaving though and needed a replacement, and so I took that job. And I actually left IBS slightly earlier than I was supposed to. I didn't quite finish the 2 years, and then I went to Committee of Responsibility for about 9 months, I think.
But IBS released you from contract?
Yeah, IBS released me, and the Selective Service agreed to recognize Committee of Responsibility to finish off whatever time I owed them on my 2 years, and I was done.
Okay, what was the Committee of Responsibility?
That was a group of doctors and housewives, I guess, who formed it. I only knew it from the other end. I think in the United States it was doctors and housewives getting together, and they decided to bring war-injured children to the United States for medical treatment. Their idea was that lots and lots of children were walking around Vietnam having been burned by napalm, and they needed treatment. Well, they're pretty naive in a lot of ways. First place, you get burned by napalm, you don't usually survive, so you're not walking around. And as it turns out, most of the injuries were not burns at all. They were bullets. But these people put together a really impressive organization that consisted of doctors who volunteered their time, hospitals who volunteered their facilities, and families who volunteered their homes to put up the kids.